Anyway, most of you should have read the article printed out from Buddhist India. Now, this book, Buddhist India, by T.W. Rhys-Davids, is an absolute classic and is one of the definitive works of early modern Indological studies. They're called Modernist Buddhism. And he has done a lot of work given the summaries of many decades of study of Buddhism in that book, and many of his essays are still very worth reading even after so many years. And this particular essay on the Jatakas is always something I've always remembered as being a very clear and very interesting one, giving a overall perspective on the Jataka stories, their place in history and so on. And I'll just summarise a few of the things here. I just want to check. Okay, so yeah, here's the. That's what I suspected. This website's only got the. I don't know, you can really see it anyway, but it's only got the verses for the actual Jatakas themselves. And as you read in the article, that technically, the verses of the Jataka stories are the canonical part, and that the actual prose story is technically a commentary. And as Rhys-Davids points out, actually, in the existing text, the manuscripts which they used, they only had the text and commentary together. So the actual, just the verses by themselves, doesn't seem to have actually existed in Theravadan culture. I've never heard of any text of it with just the verses. But this does just have the verses. It's a digital edition. And as he shows in the story, that in his analysis of the story, the text and the verses go together, so that you can't imagine having the verses without the story. So even though the text is, the prose is technically commentary, in fact the whole thing forms one unit, and in some form or another must have been passed down together since the earliest times, because this being very characteristic of Indian oral literature. Just to summarise a few of the points which Rhys-Davids makes in his essay here, and just at the end he has a summary. The canonical book contains only the verses. It was composed in the North India, in the so-called Middle Country, before the time of Ashoka, and it was still unpublished. Okay, so the claim that it was compiled before the time of Ashoka is probably a bit excessive. It's probably, I would say, after Ashoka, although many of the stories may be pre-Ashoka. It's absolutely certain that with these verses, there must have been handed down from the first an oral commentary giving the stories in prose, for the verses without the stories are unintelligible. Yeah, of course.
The first point, when it says it is still unpublished, I mean, what does that actually mean?
It means that no one's published the verses without the prose commentary, yeah. It's a bit like the situation in the Vinaya, where you have the...
How can you say the canonical book of the Jatakas contains only verses?
Because the prose section is considered to be the commentary. Yeah. And as you see here, this is the canonical part here that we just had, and it's just the verses.
Okay.
Yeah. And whether this actually represents any manuscript tradition, or whether this is the invention of the modern editors, I'm not sure. Yeah.
So it's still not published. I mean.
Not on the paper anyway. Yeah.
To be precise, it's still unpublished in verse form, you know, the second.
That's right, yeah. So it's a bit similar to the situation with the Bhikkhuni Parimokkha,
yeah,
where you only have it embedded in the text, you don't have it as a separate entity. Bhikkhu Parimokkha is similar within the canon. I mean, just to illustrate that, it's a bit hard because we don't have the digital edition, but you can see here, just to open up a random page, and here in the published edition, you can see here, he's printed this is the origins, the background story here, and then this is the prose narrative here. Go right here, everyone can have a look, and then here the verses. Now after each verse is a word commentary. So here in the small font here is the actual word by word commentary on the verses. But there's no word by word commentary on the prose, because the prose itself is part of the commentary. So this is, the whole thing is a bit of a melange, actually. There's all these different kinds of textual thing put in there at once, which makes it, of course, a bit awkward to read. Sometimes the prose just paraphrases the verse. Sometimes they say different things, and so they have a different relationship to each other, complex relationship. Of course, the fact that there was prose stories from the beginning, handed down with the verse, doesn't mean it's the same prose story that we have now. Okay, so the prose, generally speaking, the stories would have been subject to elaboration in the oral tradition, whereas the verses would have been more set, tended to be more set. And so he says that many of them are represented in the bas-reliefs of the 3rd century BC, and again, I think the dates of these would probably be revised a bit later these days, maybe 1st to 2nd century BC, from the Bharut stupas. And this is the Indira Gandhi Foundation in India, so it has some very nice photos of these things. So this is just some photos. It's very difficult. Not much point in having a look at blobs of grey stuff on the thing. If anyone's interested, they can. I can show them these later on the computer. So, but you have at least one example in the printer, and the picture of the actual story in that Rhys Davids analyses.
Okay. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, it's the dudes with the hair, and we can hopefully get a close up on some of the hairstyles. It takes close detail. Fortunately, this doesn't give much information.
Where's Bharut?
Bharut in, central India somewhere. Here we have what looks like two jackals fighting over a piece of meat or something, and getting hit. Here's a peacock. Figures in many of the jatakas. Here's a monkey jataka. Some guys down here and the monkeys leaping up here. Many monkeys feature in the jatakas. Here's another one. So elephants bathing a woman as she's holding a lotus. So there's very many of these, and you can see how they would have been used, at least one of their functions would have been used as storytelling aids. And so when you go there, it's actually quite, it's quite fun irresistible thing of doing that even today when you visit these places. And people see these images and they just say, oh, what's this one or what's that one? And you end up sort of talking about it, and then somebody will tell the story. And so it's a very engaging way of doing it, because the images themselves, you get some more close-ups of the hairstyle. Maybe this is the men's hairstyles, this is the women's hairstyle. It's got some more kind of thing across there. There you go, there's the turban, there's the whole thing. So there's probably a king or something like that. You have to be to get away with wearing one of them. So, but very detailed. And probably quite realistic in their depiction of the styles of the time. This one's an interesting one. Here we have... Here we have a nice vague grey blob there. Okay, now here we see in the front, in the top circle here, we have a woman with all the gear on and stuff, so she's probably a queen of some sort. Lotuses, right? And underneath, at the bottom of it, we have this very ugly fellow with a big belly and very ugly face who's sitting underneath her and holding onto lotuses. And this is probably... a representation of the Kusa Jataka, which is one of my favourite ones. And there the Bodhisattva appears as this fellow who's very wise and very intelligent, but very ugly and very very tricksy. He gets kind of betrothed to this beautiful princess, and she's so horrified to see him that she runs away and so on, and then he's trying to... They actually made an arrangement that they weren't allowed to see each other in the daytime because the mother was so horrified that the princess would run away. So he went and, so he could get a glimpse of his beloved in the daytime, he went and hid in the bathing pond when she was going bathing, and hid behind a lotus. And and then she came into the pond, and he was hiding behind one of the lotuses, and then pulled the lotus out and from behind it and said, "Oh, I'm your husband," and she screams, "Ah! It's a monster!" stone! And runs off. But that's a fantastic one, the Kusa Jataka. If anyone's interested to read any of the Jatakas for sheer enjoyment, Kusa Jataka is great. And the other one is the Maha Umagga Jataka, the second last one, which is a very, very rich text full of tricks and riddles and skillful means and all kinds of things. Very, very supposed to illustrate the Buddha's parami wisdom. It's got lots of all kinds of devices and problems and all kinds of fun things. I don't know if you're familiar with the story that Brecht used in the thing, a play called The Caucasian Chalk Circle. I remember studying when I was a kid, and there was the idea that there's two women competing over who owns the baby. You know that story? And they've got a chalk line, and they have to see who's going to pull the baby across over the chalk line. So Brecht called it the Caucasian Chalk Circle. And of course the idea being that the real mother isn't going to pull the baby over. Yeah? And that the fake one is, of course in the Jataka version of that, the fake mother is a yakini who's going to eat the baby. So that's in there, and many other tests which the Bodhisattva has to solve. So this is just to give you a bit of an idea of how they fit in. I know this is not about Jatakas as such, but this is, you see this big crowd of people here, and then in the middle, this empty space. Okay, so this is the empty seat. This is where the Buddha was sitting, on the empty seat. There's a close up of the seat.
Are these sculptures being in situ, or are they in museums?
Barut. Yeah, I mean, they're huge stupas which are carved and covered all over. So yeah, there's hundreds of individual images. Most of them, I think, are still in situ. I'm not sure about these ones as such. They look pretty clean. Whether they were just cleaned up. Yeah, maybe they're in a museum, or maybe they got cleaned up just for the hard to say. Again, I'm not sure if that's an artifact of the lighting. It's probably exaggerated by the lighting. This is another one over here. This is another interesting one. So, anyway, here's some other. These ones obviously in situ. Yeah, this is a version of the Salabhanjika. Yeah, it is. It's the same. Basically, the image of Maya was taken from this genre. Yeah. Yeah, clutching. She's clutching a tree. Yeah. Let's bend over. Okay, so that's that. So I don't have. I don't have the jump. That's what I don't have. Okay. Do you want to pop downstairs and grab them? There, downstairs in the. So this is the English translation, and we're very lucky in the English-speaking world that in the early times, in the 19th century, they actually edited and translated in English all of the Jatakas. These were even done before the major Nikayas were all translated. So, and the translations, I mean, of course, they're archaic by modern standards, but they're still quite good. The only problems with the translations as such is that the verses were translated into rhyming verse, which I think is justifiable in the sense that it sort of keeps the kind of folk or popular feel of the Jataka, but it's often proven very difficult to actually capture the literal meaning of the verse in the thing, so not particularly reliable. So there's 547 Jatakas listed in the Pali Jataka book. There are many more, probably hundreds more, found in the northern sources. Sanskrit, Chinese, Tibetan sources all have lots of Jatakas, and as well in the Pali tradition we find much later groups of Jatakas, which are not found in this collection. We find, as Rhys Davies mentions in his article, a few which are found in the early Nikayas, which are not featured in the canonical collection. And we also find large collections of retellings of Jatakas, so in Sinhala and other languages. Okay. So.
And you said that this word was in Sinhala and translated to Pali.
Well, it was probably originally in Pali or something like Pali, and then if it's Indian. And then probably passed. Well, the commentaries generally were passed down in Sinhala for a few hundred years, and then translated back into Pali. Always remembering that Sinhala and Pali in those days were very similar, and that actually, I mean, linguistically, it's interesting that the actual motivation for retranslating it back into Pali was the fact that the Sinhala had by then become archaic. Yeah. So you then had, by say 3rd or 4th, 5th century in Sri Lanka, you had Pali, archaic Sinhalese, and the actual colloquial Sinhalese, which had already moved on. So you actually had to learn two sacred languages to understand the texts. So they either, rather than modernising all the language, it's a bit like in Chinese, where the Buddhist texts are in such an ancient Chinese that most people, unless they've done special study, they can't really read it. So they put it all back into Pali. And of course, as Rhys Davids explains in his article, the Jatakas, for the most part, are not considered part of the early literature of Buddhism. And it's not really sure to what extent the Buddha actually used Jatakas as a teaching means. It's interesting to notice or to reflect that if we look in the suttas, in the primary and the central passages where he talks about rebirth and he talks about remembering his own life, the context that he's talking about is that of understanding the nature of rebirth and the nature of samsara, yeah? And so to develop his passion towards samsara because of an understanding of the pain of rebirth. And he doesn't use the past lives in that sense for telling episodes from his past lives and for drawing lessons from them, which is essentially what the Jatakas do. So there's a few cases in the Nikayas where he's actually, in the four Nikayas, where he's actually telling a Jataka in that sense, in the sense of drawing a lesson for the present day, but certainly wasn't a huge part of the early literature as collected. And so it's hard to know how many, if any, of the actual Jatakas that we have were taught by the Buddha, and certainly fairly likely that most of them were simply stories or tales which circulated in the oral tradition of India and which were adopted within a Buddhist context. And as Rhys Davids says in his article, that there's not actually many specifically Buddhist features in a lot of the Jatakas. Some of the Jatakas do have specifically Buddhist features. For example, they will have a mention of heretics who are discussing the various kinds of wrong views which are conventionally mentioned in the Nikayas and the refutation of those wrong views. Okay, so these are found. And there's actually a wonderful text of that sort called the Vidura Pandita Jataka, which has a quite astonishing set of verses which are critique of Brahmanical practices. And actually one of the most interesting critiques of notion of a creator god and all kinds of things. So we do find these kind of philosophical texts in a few of the Jatakas, but for the most part they deal with very simple ethical issues. So then question arises as to then what's the purpose of studying the Jatakas, or what are we looking at when we're studying the Jatakas? So there are a few good reasons for having some familiarity with the literature. One is simply the most obvious reason, which is that the Jatakas often tell some good stories and they often have some good Dhamma messages in there and so on. And so that's, I think, not a bad reason for wanting to study them. Second reason is that the Jatakas are incredibly important in Buddhist culture. and all Buddhist cultures, both Theravada and Mahayana, throughout the centuries and the millennia, have regarded these things as being extremely important, and have they've been a central part of their understanding of their own religion. So it's difficult for us these days to take a lot of the things in the Jatakas as literally as they're presented, or they seem to have been presented in the text, and have probably been taken by many people over the years. So, you know, we don't really believe that the rabbit on the moon, for example, was made by Sakha in celebration of the Bodhisattva's sacrifice as a rabbit in his past life, and he then took up a mountain and squeezed the juice out of the mountain and used it for painting a the sign of a rabbit on the moon. Okay, so... Well, it's still wanting. I mean, it hasn't been conclusively disproven. Okay, I believe that NASA has a division working on that particular theory, but still, it's quite a nice story, you know. And anyway, so, but it does help us to understand how Buddhists think and how they perceive their religion. So,
and so much of the inclusion of the Jataka in a canonical sense, yeah, is modern.
No, the verses were in the Kudaka, yeah, but part of the later part of the Kudaka.
The actual prose part?
No, the verses. Yeah.
And the prose is?
Commentary.
Commentary.
Yeah.
So, like a four-line stanza or something?
In some cases a four-line stanza, in some cases, you know, dozens or, you know, close to 100 verses that will tell the story in the later ones.
And the stories themselves, yeah, the folklore is likely the millennia or many millennia old.
Can well be, yeah. Much of the actually that's something that continue with these still going on. What about? Yes, but that's quite right. Many of the stories may be older than the actual collection itself.
Mm.
Yeah.
So that's where the confusion can arise, because some of the stories seem to have a very old nature about them, which, yeah, is the text, the seeming authority of age,
yeah,
but,
yeah,
with modern commentary.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, I've skipped over. I lost my place here. So before I keep on going with that, talking about the reasons for studying the Jataka, I just want to finish summarising what Rhys Davies said here at the end of his article. Bas reliefs, there are Jataka stories in the canonical books that are older than the Jataka book. Okay, here he's talking about the ones in the Nikayas. These oldest extant Jatakas are similes, parables or legends. They usually give us neither framework nor verses in them. The Buddha in his previous birth is never identified with an animal or even with an ordinary man. He is identified only with some famous sage of bygone times. Right? Our present edition is not an edition of the text, but the commentary, probably written in the 5th century in Sri Lanka by an author whose name is not known. This commentary, which contains all the verses, contains also the prose stories in which they occur, and adds a framework of an introductory episode stating when and where and on what occasion the story is supposed to have been spoken by the Buddha, and the final identification of the characters in each story with the Buddha and his contemporaries in a previous birth. Okay, this commentary is a translation into Pali of the commentary handed down in Sri Lanka. That earlier commentary was in Sinhalese language throughout, except as regards the verses, which were in Pali. Pali commentary, as we now have it, has the stories of tradition have been handed down from the 3rd century BC. Okay, again, that's a little bit early. As regards to the allusions to political and social conditions, they refer to the most part to the state of things that existed in North India in and before the Buddha's time. Okay, so that's an important point, and there's a most obvious example of that. Is that the Jatakas are constantly talking about Brahmadatta, the king of Benares. And by the Buddha's time, Benares had been conquered by Kosala and wasn't a kingdom anymore. So the very fact that there was a king of Benares refers to a political situation that existed before the Buddha's time in ancient India. Kosala was also a kingdom, but there was no king of Benares. There was king of Kosala after that. Yeah. And then Benares was warred over by Kosala and Magadha. Magadha eventually won it and was swallowed up in Ashoka's empire. So.
Is Kasi Benares?
Kasi is Kathi is often the old name of the Narad. Yeah, Kathi means the light or the shining one, the shining place.
Just a
nice
question.
Of
course,
yeah.
The Tathagata are of the Buddha's life prior to his Buddha. So would it be appropriate if I spoke about King Naris, that's a different king to the king who was born?
Yes, it is, yeah. So the stories are supposed to be older, and in many cases they probably are in fact older, yeah. But of course the stories are not as old as they claim to be. So the stories often claim to be from like previous, you know, thousands of births ago or something like that. So they're not that old, but mostly the social and political conditions seem to be maybe 200-400 years before the Buddha, something like that. Like you don't have much recollection, for example, the steel technology, the use of iron, is taken for granted through the Jatakas, yeah? Whereas that technology didn't exist very much prior to that in ancient India. So, you know, that's the technology is sort of around that time, so 6th, 7th, 8th century BC. When the original Jataka was being gradually formed, most of the stories were taken bodily over from the existing folklore of northern India. Some progress has already been made in determining the relative age at that time of the stories. Those in the sixth and last volumes are both the longest and the latest. Some of these were already selected for illustration on the bas-relief of the 3rd century BCE, so that means these carvings here. So what he's suggesting is that even among the later versions, the later of the Jataka stories, we already find them in the illustrations. One of the things that he's doing here is he's constructing an argument for the earliness and the authenticity of the Pali canon, okay? And this is part of what he wants to do. So we say this is arguing that even the later Jatakas are already found in these inscriptions, in these sculptures. How much more so the earlier Jatakas must have existed at that time, and how much more so the teachings in the Nikayas must have existed at that time. So this is one of the ways that we are able to date or to say that the Nikaya teachings must be from an early period of time. And his last conclusion here is the whole collection forms the most reliable, the most complete, and the most ancient collection of folklore now extant in any literature. And one thing that he doesn't mention in that summary there is that the stories in the Jatakas are not only identified within Indian literature, but also found elsewhere in Aesop's fables and in folklore that's collected around the world. So these things would have travelled along the trading routes and as part of the common literature of humanity. Okay? So, just to come back to what I was talking about before, the reasons for studying the Jatakas, one is the fact that they're good stories and often have a good bit of Dhamma in there. Second, that they help us to understand Buddhist culture and Buddhist peoples and Buddhist communities. And of course, part of that means that, you know, as we know very well from Buddhist people, are people, and being people, they're not necessarily going to think my spiritual practice involves doing intensive vipassana retreats and doing a technical Abhidhamma analysis of dependent origination, and that's what my spiritual practice consists of. But being people, they also like to be entertained, and they also like to have fun, and they like to have a laugh, and they also like to produce beautiful works of art, and so on. And so the Jataka stories provided a means for assimilating and for the expressing of creativity among Buddhist people throughout the years, both in artworks, also in plays and so on, dramatic performances. In Thailand, before the modernist reforms of the late 19th century in Thailand, it was very common in different areas that in the monasteries the Jatakas would be presented as a kind of a play or a show, and the monks would be like the actors. So this would be like folk regional traditions where they didn't get dressed up and do all the voices and things like that for the Jatakas. And so this was considered undignified by the reformers of the Sangha in the late 19th century. So that tradition has unfortunately been lost. So that's another reason. Third reason, as mentioned, is that they give us a huge amount of endless background detail and information which fleshes out our knowledge of the culture and time and place where the Buddha was living and where he was teaching. And they enable us to capture vividly things like we see in front of us here, the headdress and the hairstyles that people were wearing at the time, and give us a chance to more imaginatively enter into the world that the Buddha was living in, to understand what were the concerns, the needs, the values of the people that the Buddha was teaching. And of course that allows us to appreciate some of the ideas and the emphases that we find in the Nikayas as well. No, he's got earlobes, yeah. Oh yeah, he has, yeah. No, it's not an ascetic thing, it's a royal thing, he's a king. Yeah, no, he has, that's right, he has several very heavy gold earrings. I mean, this one in the corner, there's a square block here. Mm. Looks almost like just a block of gold or something it would have been. And you can see, I don't know how clearly you can make it out on there, but actually this mark here is actually the hole in his ear, which is pulled down by the weight of the earring. Yeah. So there's the things like that. So, I mean, there's... And just one example that struck me when I was reading some Jatakas recently is you have this thing in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta where when the Lichavis and Ambapali meet each other on the road and they nearly run their chariots into each other, and the Lichavis have just invited the Buddha for Dana. Oh no, Ambapali's just invited the Buddha for Dana the next day, and they run up against the Lichavis and they say, oh, we want to invite him for Dana, and they have this argument about it, and the Lichavis click their fingers. I don't know if you remember that from the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. That mango woman, and they're clicking their fingers. But that comes up time and time again in the Jatakas, and people seem to have been a quite a regular thing. Their wrestlers, when they get into the ring, will go around yelling, a bit like kind of pro-wrestling kind of thing, and taunting their opponents and clicking their fingers at them. You know, so this was obviously a kind of cultural expression at the time. So this is... another reason for studying, and a final reason for studying, or fourth reason for studying, which is probably the most interesting for me, is that, as you know, I'm very interested in mythology, and that the stories and the tales which are handed down express various kinds of ideas, which are things that are not necessarily so amenable to expression in terms of explicit or normal or rational philosophical discourse that we tend to find mostly in the suttas. And so there are other needs or ideas which are part of our minds, part of our consciousness, and which I think in some way that these stories address in one way or another. And that's probably a bit mysterious, but I'll talk about that a bit more as we go on. So that's just been a bit of a summary of Rhys David's article and a bit of a background. Does anyone have any questions on that before we move on to the next section? Okay, so it's like 457 Jatakas. Right. Now each Jataka has basically two stories. So it's got the old story of the past and the new story of events that are supposed to have happened in the Buddha's life. Now, if you think about it, it's quite an accomplishment, right? To find nearly 550 stories of the past and then 550 events in the present, and to match them all up and say there's some parallel between them, it's not an easy thing to do, yeah? And so it invites a question as to why was that so meaningful? Why was there such an effort made to actually match up specific and particular acts that are done in the past with events, particular events that happened in the present, with these events that happened in the past? And one of the things which comes out when you read these stories again and again and again is that in the events in the present tend to be more localized, particular, personal, whereas the events that happen in the past tend to be more universal, more mythic, more magical. And so it's almost like these are the archetypal stories which are finding expression in a particular form in a time and place during the time of the Buddha. Okay, so this is this idea of these kind of universality of these messages, which is sort of illustrated by particular episodes that happened during the time the Buddha's life. In particular, you find that the stories address certain key issues within the Buddhist community, and the most important of those is the question of renunciation. Now, the Jatakas as a whole, right, this whole thing is the whole Jataka stories, right? Now, at the beginning of that is another book which we don't have here, which is actually the Jataka Nidana, which gives the origin of the Jatakas, like the Bodhisattva's first determination to become a Buddha. That wasn't translated as part of his collection, it's in a separate volume. Okay, so all these three volumes and another one, and this is like this is the prelude, okay, to the Buddha's birth, or the Siddhartha's birth in this life. Right, this whole thing is one continuity with the life of the Buddha, and forms the introduction, yeah, as a set of narratives with the life of the Buddha. This is telling the story, in one sense, of everything the Buddha had done leading up to his present life. And within that story, within that narrative framework, that story of the Buddha's life, of course, is often called the Great Renunciation, Mahanekama. And the crux of that story, of course, or one of the cruxes of it, is that episode where he leaves the palace and goes forth. Okay, so that's that central decision that he has to make. And we've discussed that before in our classes about that question of, you know, what did he do when he left his family? Yeah, how did he feel, or how is that justifiable? Was that an ethical choice to leave your wife and children behind and leave your family behind and so on? And so it's that crux, that ethical dilemma, which is almost like the kernel of the Buddha's myth or the Buddha's story. Okay. To stay in home or to go forth, and that's expressed in the suttas again and again, where it's said that as one who possesses the marks of a great man, he could either stay as a lay person, stay in the home life, and in which case he would become a wheel-turning monarch and a ruler, a just and righteous ruler of the whole of India, or if he went forth, he would become a fully enlightened Buddha. So we have this choice, okay? And of course we know in our life that he chose one of those options. He chose to go forth. Now, when that same choice comes up throughout the Jatakas again and again and again and again, probably not every Jataka, but in most of them, in one way or another, that choice is presented. And he doesn't always make the same choice. Yeah? He makes different choices and resolves that problem in different ways, in different contexts. So in one case, he might decide, I'm going to go forth and live as a hermit in the Himalayas, and he goes and lives by himself as a hermit in the Himalayas. And that's the classical scenario. But there's many variations of that. Sometimes he might be a king, and he might decide to retire and just live a contemplative life in a hut in the royal palace. So in the palace gardens, he would live there. So that would be one option, right? Another option would be the other way around. He might be an ascetic in the Himalayas and then come down and actually live in the king's palace and perform the ascetic's duties there. Or he might go forth into the forest but take his family with him. Okay, so sometimes he goes forth with his wife, or he has a son or a sister. Yeah? Sometimes they have the whole family, the extended family, sometimes the whole city. In some Jatakas, they even have several kingdoms. All decide to go forth at the same time, right? And all the cities are abandoned, and they're all going. And Sakka says, "Oh my goodness, I'll have to do something about this." So Sakka then creates all these massive hermitages, which cover the whole of the Himalayas, and then supply everything so that the whole of India can go and go forth at the same time, and all the cities are abandoned, and everyone's going and practicing meditation. So this is another variation or way that, and then, but in other places he doesn't decide to go forth. In other places he decides to adopt his worldly duties and responsibilities, and to continue those. And again, that might happen in various ways, depending on the context. So one example, and so these things sometimes are counterintuitive. So there's one example which I thought was a very sweet one when I was reading this, and this is a story of one of the kings who decides to go hunting. He left his kingdom and was wandering alone in the forest, in the Himalayas, hunting, and he comes across these two Kinnarets, okay, these two divine nymphs, a man and a woman, who are sitting by the side of a beautiful stream in the Himalayas, and there's flowers and fruit everywhere, and they're sitting, and they're alternatively smiling and hugging each other, and then bursting into tears and crying. Okay, now this story was given to illustrate an event in the life of the Buddha where Malika, the queen of Kosala and Mount Pasenadi, her husband, had had an argument over, as the translation says, conjugal rights. Okay, and so it seems that the king wasn't so happy with the decisions Malika was making regarding conjugal rights. And so this was to illustrate that particular thing, and they'd spent the night sleeping apart, and so the king was quite depressed. And so anyway, in the story of the past, then they come on, and these two Kinnaras are there, and the hunter says, "Oh, you know, what are you doing?" And they say, "Oh, here we are, we're so in love with each other," and so on. And he says, "Well, why are you crying? Yeah, and why are you so sad when you love each other so much, and then you have each other here?" And then one of the Kinnaras says, "Oh, well, it's because I was separated from my husband, and that he was wandering looking for flowers to make an ornament for me, a garland for me, and he wandered across the stream, and when he was across the stream rose up, and he couldn't find his way back across, and so we were separated all night, yeah, and because we were separated all night, I was longing for him so much." That this is why we're so sad and we're crying, and the king says, "Oh, that's terrible, you know. But you know, it's surely that's, you know, you're only separated for one night, and you know it's now in the daytime, it's the afternoon already. You know, why are you still crying?" And they said to him, No, you don't understand. That was 700 years ago. We were separated for one night, yeah? and so the king at that time." His reflection was, "Oh, here they've been parted from their loved ones for one night, and that shows how important our loved ones are for us." And so then he thinks, "I shouldn't be wandering around here while all my family and responsibilities are back in my kingdom." So then he decides to go back to his kingdom and to be with his family and to do his duties, yeah, in his lay life. So this is another way of resolving that question. And so it's not always answered the same way. Now, when I was looking at this kind of thing, and I was thinking, it reminds me of the theories of mythology which were developed by a fellow called Levi Strauss. I'm not sure if anyone's familiar with his work as an anthropologist, and he did a lot of work in mythology and anthropology, which was very interesting, but it's also very enigmatic, and I'm not entirely sure that I really understand his work that well, but from what I gather, or what I understand of it, is that he was very fascinated by this idea that folk tales are often constructed around this kind of dualism. Okay, so again, in this choice, in our case, the dualism is to go forth or to stay in the home life, and so you have like a black and white situation, and when a story is told, one or other of those choices may be made. Okay. And so the titles of his works often reflect this kind of dualism. One of it's called The Raw and the Cooked, another one The Sacred and the Profane. And so there's these kind of dualities which are set up in the stories. But what he noticed was that if you look at not just individual stories, but if you look at collections or clusters of stories which are similar, that they will negotiate that dualism with shades of grey. It won't always be the same choice. so that within one story we have a black and white option, either or. It's like a logical choice. You have to either stay in the home or go forth. Yeah. But if you look at many, many stories over time, which is in fact what would happen within the Buddhist culture, that they would hear these different stories at different times and assimilate them in a different way, then you realise that it's not actually a black and white choice. Each story, each presentation, presents one particular way that this choice was negotiated. But there are many other possible outcomes and possible ways that that choice can be negotiated. And so in that way, by focusing on clusters and groups of stories, you move towards an ethic which is more contextual, more nuanced, and more subtle than just a black and white ethic, which is just either or. Okay, so rather than saying, again, in the context we're talking about now, that either renunciation or the home life is necessarily the right way or the best way or whatever, but to say that in different times, in different places, in different contexts, that there are different choices that can be made, okay, and that they will have different outcomes. So I found that this is a very fruitful way of thinking about the Jataka stories and looking at how they've developed and work within a Buddhist community. Now, when I was I've been rereading and doing a bit of research on these things for the last year or so, and in doing that, one of the reasons I came, obviously, for I was doing my research on the mythology around bhikkhunis and the role of women in Buddhism. And one of the questions which occurred to me a couple of years ago was a question as to where or what is the in mythological studies you have the hero myth, okay, which is a very central story, and the hero myth is Ulysses or Hercules or Gilgamesh or the Buddha and so on, and their lives follow. Stories tend to follow a certain pattern which has certain familiar motifs, and that hero myth is very central in the development of a culture and so on. Now, that hero myth is typically male, okay? So the hero is typically a bloke, and the activities that they do are typically masculine, okay? They go out, they go into the forest, they take their swords, they battle people and overcome obstacles and all of those kinds of things. And so I was kind of wondering, well, what's the woman's story? What's is there a heroine myth, okay? And what is that presentation or the typical features that we might find for stories of women in mythology and so on? And what might that tell us as to both the role of men and women in the cultures, but also in terms of on a more psychological level of notions of masculinity and femininity which we each have within our own minds. So this is one of the questions that I've been looking at and trying to pay attention to some of these stories. Now, in the Jatakas as such, being primarily the story of the Bodhisattva, then of course primarily the male figure is the hero, and rarely do we find you find plenty of women in strong roles in the Jatakas, but rarely do you find where they form the central role. To some degree, yeah. But this is also one of the missing features of it, because in the just like in the Vinaya tradition, in Vinaya studies we've been doing, we find that the men have control of the formal redaction process, but the bhikkhunis had, there's still traces of the bhikkhunis' oral literature there. similar thing with the myths is that the
oral literature that they would have memorised themselves and passed down, like the Kadimoka, the Kikunis, deciphered so it passed down. But I would imagine that in the early times when the things were being written down, when there were a lot of Kikunis around, probably. Mm. So I just imagine that a lot of women's mythology and storytelling that would have happened, you know, sitting around sewing or
absolutely, yeah. And I'm sure a lot of it has been, but just as the Bikunis literature was at least to some degree adopted within the Tripitaka, in the same way I think that the women's stories are often adopted within the Jataka's tales and things like that. So that's also an interesting thing to see whether that's happened and when and where. So for example, you know, you might have stories that are put into the mouth of or said to be spoken by the old women in the village or something like that. Yeah, but certainly the final redaction process is more or less controlled by the monks. And and there's no doubt that you find very, very strong misogynistic strands in the Jatakas, and some of the Jatakas are vile and contemptible in their presentation of women, and have had a very, very pernicious influence on Buddhist culture in encouraging misogynistic ideas. Although again, this is also something which is complex, because you just as easily find one passage that says all women are foolish and blah 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 and blah blah blah, and then in the next one it'll have this incredibly wise woman who plays a really kind of strong role and is really praised. The difference is, and something I've noticed quite consistently, that whenever a woman does anything bad, that the story says, therefore women are bad, but if they do something good, they say, oh, this woman is good. Yeah. So that's that.
In there are quite a few chapters and are like really warning from what women do about, like, there's a jataka, the title is about the wrongness of women or what to treat women.
That's right.
I don't know how to falsehype falsehood.
The wickedness of women. Nice.
Yeah.
Iti dosa. Yeah. Yeah. And all of the cliches are there, right?
Yes.
All of the cliches are there. And I just could you pop down to my room? In my office there's on my desk there's a small black notebook. About that big. You want to bring that up? Yeah, that's just got some notes that I need for them. So yeah, you find this kind of overlay, but again, when I was researching and looking at the stories of Mahapajapati and others, it always struck me, and I think that this is something that's difficult to prove or anything like that, but it struck me that there seems to be a difference between an underlying mythic meaning to a lot of these stories, and particularly the depictions of women, which is actually in some sense quite profound, and then a surface personalization of those motifs, and where the mythic role of a woman is, when it's presented in a personal terms, appears to be very very pernicious or very wrong or something, but when it's seen in a mythic role is actually quite a profound characterization. That's not a very clear explanation. I'll just give you an example. That women in sort of feminine forms in very primal mythology tend to be the governors of creation. And as the governors of creation, they're also the governors of destruction. Yeah? So they're the life-producing force, which is also, because producing life, also producing death. And so this is this idea of a woman who's the fates, which you have in Greek mythology, of governing the course of life and death. So, and in that way she's considered to be an embodiment of the cycles of nature. But when that's put into a personal form, It becomes a woman who kills, right, rather than a woman who's an embodiment of the nature of the cycles of life and death. Okay, so this is one of the problems. And so when I was looking at these, I found so here's a typical verse about women in the Jatakas. Desire is called woman in the world. They know no limit. Lustful and insatiable, they devour all like the crested flame. Having left them, I will go forth to develop seclusion. So this is the kind of thing we find quite frequently. The objectification. As long as there's mention of wanderers and ascetics, you find mention of women there, and it's the same both in the Buddhist texts, also in the Hindu and Jaina texts. That question is also asked in the Jatakas. It says, you know, one time when the Bodhisattva says, "I want to go forth," and his wife says, you know, he says, "I want to, you know, settle my arrangements in the house before I go forth," and his wife says, "Well, is that life gone forth just for men or for women as well?" And he says, "No, it can be for anyone." And so she says, "Well, I'll go forth with you as well." So then they go together to a hermitage in the mountains. Yeah.
But in Brahmanical times, I mean, the Brahmins, women, were allowed to, you know, it was the sole domain of men. If women went forth in, you know, a Brahmin.
There are certainly some statements about that in the Hindu Dharma Shastras, and there's no doubt that the Brahmanical tradition was basically a patriarchal tradition, and they're pretty ferocious in their wanting to monopolize the reciting of the Vedas and so on. They say if a sudra, one of the low caste, hears the Vedas, he should have molten metal poured in his ears, and if he recites the Vedas, he should have his tongue pulled out. And so women didn't get much of a look in there. However, even in the Upanishads, which predate the Buddha, and which may be contemporary with the Buddha, with the Jatakas, you find women participating at a very high level in philosophical debates, not just reciting texts, but actually competing and being at the very top level of the advanced philosophical discussions at the time. So I think that the law books, perhaps more of a depiction of what the some of the men wanted rather than necessarily what happened.
One of those probably famous ones is the wanderer who encounters Harry Potter, wandering around on the bank, having arguments with the Sandy Tower.
Yep. Yeah, so that's part of the story of Buddha, and it appears in quite a few of the stories here. So, and again, it's seen to be something that's pretty normal. It's not sort of remarked on specially or being very unusual.
It's also dependent on the era that the actual translations were made. For example, the translations were made in Sri Lanka. What type of society was that at that time? It was a very much patriarchal society. Even if the thing they were looking at was, say, more even, would the translation come across as quite different? Or would they have been translated to certain stories?
Absolutely, yeah. So there's a whole selection process, which is very important.
Mm-hmm.
And, many... as you say, the whole translation redaction process, there are many hands embodied in the work. It's not just one thing. Yeah.
Were there any possible stories with Buddha in the past life as a woman, whether those could have been all monks would do that?
Ah, yeah. Yeah. There's absolutely. He's an animal in many of them, yeah, but he's not a woman. Yeah. The only one of the disciples, I think. Okay, let's see if you can guess, okay? Buddhist quiz. Okay, of all the Buddhist disciples. You don't even have to ask the question. Who's the only one who gets sex change in his different lives? And not only does he get a sex change, he then talks about how after many lives he was born as a castrated animal or as a eunuch and so on in life after life. So he obviously had some... Well, according to the Buddhist perception anyway, there were some gender issues involved with Ananda and his take on things. That's true, yeah, but that's more of this life kind of occurrence, yeah. But it is an interesting kind of projection. Well, now you may... It actually happens. Yeah, it does actually happen. Look, I kind of suspect that it arose in conversations of monks who had a little bit too much time on their hands, right? And they sort of end up discussing what would happen if... And, so that's my kind of suspicion. But actually, biologically, it does actually happen. Well, it tends to happen at adolescence. There's a certain tribe in Africa, I believe, they have a certain... there's a certain genetic mutation or something, and quite a large number of them have spontaneous sex changes at adolescence.
Mm-hmm. You know, there are people that have like XX and Y chromosomes, so they are more male
or female, so maybe when they're a child, they like male, and then they can grow up and they're
like female.
Yeah.
Because
sort of
mixed mosaic people, because they have both.
Yeah, hermaphrodites, yeah.
And that changes, of course, with the age.
Yeah. And that's interesting because that's also this black and white, this idea of the black and white, that you think, well, you're either male or female, but then there's actually this is actually all grey areas. And there was an interesting article by this hermaphrodite in Perth in the newspaper when I was there years ago, and he/she was saying, you know, you kind of laugh at it, but what toilet do I go to when you're in the kind of public and there's the men's and there's the women's, and which one do I go into, you know?
The
proper term
is
intersex. Intersex, is it? Okay, sorry. Pardon me.
And it's actually a standard. It is actually a medicine. lost their parents if they left when they were born.
Yeah.
And then it, I can find
because, yeah, so.
Yeah, it's very cultural. I think they're rather cultural, they don't sort of put so much weight on it. It really matters so much. I read this fascinating book a few years ago about a. He was actually a very famous surgeon who was credited with performing the first successful cesarean operation on the wife of the governor of Cape Town back in 1800s, very early 1800s. Anyway, and he was this fellow, he was actually in the British Navy as a surgeon for many, many, many years. But he was incredibly feminine. He always wore, he was in the days of the dandy Prince Regent in England. He wore this amazing clothes and was there. You know, in those days men wore makeup and it was sort of normal.
Yeah.
And then the sort of behaviour that he would have considered okay then, but now that was probably and it turned out he actually was a woman.
Yeah, she was a woman.
He was a woman, he lived his whole life, or well, she, as a male. It's amazing.
So one of the characterizations when it's talking about women in the suttas and in the jatakas, it's always as in that little verse that I just read there. One of the things that women always have lots of desire, lots of both sexual desire and just wants generally. Irrational desires of various forms, and of course this has always been a question which has puzzled men down through the years: is, well, what does a woman actually want? And this is something that Freud had to admit that he was completely unable to answer. And so the Jatakas offer some very good answers to this story that what a woman actually wants. And I was mentioning this the other day, one of my favourite ones is where there's a princess who's she's going to, they've advertised for a husband for her, so all the suitors come to the palace to see, and they say, well, whoever pleases the princess will win her hand in marriage. Okay, so the prince from another country comes to see her, and of course she's the most beautiful woman in all the land and blah 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 as usual, and then he comes into the room and she says, give me a glass of water. So he runs over to the other side, gets a glass of water, brings it here. She says, go over there, get this for me. He goes and gets it. She says, bring me a cushion. Brings her a cushion. She says, massage my feet. So he kneels down at her feet and starts massaging her feet, and then she kicks him in the head, knocks him over and says, get out of here, you idiot. Next one comes in. Next one comes in, she says, get me a glass of water. So he runs over and gets her a glass of water and so on. So all of these suitors come and they all get tossed out unceremoniously, probably get their heads chopped off or something like that. Finally, the Bodhisattva arrives. And she says, get me this, get me that, and so on. He completely ignores her and walks on past like a lion. And she gets up and rushes after him and says, please be my prince. So there's a bit of insight in some of them.
The way they behave.
Well, yeah. If you do anything that everything that the woman wants, you'll end up in trouble. So that's definitely.
No, or else if you like, if you just ignore her and don't do anything for her, that's what she actually wants.
Yeah.
So that's sort of.
So, but this idea, and it's something that actually I noticed in a set of Jataka stories which deal with this theme of a woman who has some kind of wish or some kind of desire. And this is what I did the table for, which is unfortunately completely seems to have disappeared, so it's almost completely bunged up. I'm not sure why the table didn't save, it's just saved it as text. Anyway, this is a list of jatakas. I kind of narrowed it down to about 16 tales, which tell stories which have a lot of very interesting things in common. And yeah, it would have been really nice if we had a table that we could see it in. No, it doesn't make a lot of sense. Yeah, it'll take a little bit of time. I'll try to do that. But one of the things here that I found is this use of this word dohala. And dohala, oh, it wasn't a word I was familiar with at all. I didn't know that word. But that recurs, is where these asterisks are, is where dohala occurs in the stories. And it seems to appear in most of this particular kind of story, and rarely, if ever, in other contexts. And dohala, etymologically, is from du hradaya, meaning bad heart or sad heart or something like that. And it's used particularly for this kind of almost unstoppable wish or desire that a woman has. In some of the stories, it's associated with pregnancy, and sometimes it's said to be like the cravings of a pregnant woman. And sometimes, in the stories, I notice they often translate it as that, but actually it's only in a couple of the stories that actually is in the context of pregnancy, and in many of the others she's not actually pregnant. But in some way, this particular word dohala is specifically, I can't find it used in any other context, specifically used in the sense of this kind of insatiable craving that a woman has sometimes when pregnant. And very often she says to her husband or someone, I must get it, this thing that I want, I must have it, and if I don't, I'll just lie here until I die. Okay? And then she lies there, and sometimes she does die. Right? And so this is a whole set of stories. I identified about 16 stories where it's quite close fit to this archetype, and there's many others that more loosely fit it. And she wants different kinds of things. So some here it's a golden peacock that she wants. Here it's the heart of a monkey that she wants, and so on. And so there's different things which she decides that she wants. In some cases she succeeds in getting what she wants. In some cases she doesn't. In some cases she kind of succeeds and kind of doesn't. The other interesting thing was that this set of stories occurs there's different levels of tale which repeat the same stories. So some of the stories it occurs on a fairly low level. It's a fairly, you know, like, you know, the story of a crocodile and a monkey, and it's just nothing more than just a little fable or something like that. But in other versions of it, the same pattern occurs, but at a very high level, where it clearly becomes a very powerful and a very profound spiritual search which the woman has. So what I'd like to do for the next few lessons is to read through this set of about 16 stories. Some of them more or less just replicate others, and we won't read through them all in detail, of course, we don't have time, but I'd like to go through each of these 16 stories and have a look at this, because I think it's a very interesting motif, and I've certainly found a lot of interest from that.
I think in the Bible you find that motif with the story of John the Baptist.
Uh-huh. Yeah. That's right, Salome. Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. That's another version of that same thing. Mm-hmm. And through mythology all the time, and it actually underlies, it's one of the things that really struck me, because I'm a fan of Greek myths.
Salome.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't Herod's
wife? No, I think it was his wife.
Was it Salome? Yes, Salome.
His daughter.
She was a dancer.
That's right, yeah, the dance of the 7,000.
Well,
in the play I saw, this friend of mine put on in Brisbane. So that's exactly, that's one that struck me as being very similar to some of these. And the one which is also similar is the whole basis and underlying of Greek mythology is the story of the Judgment of Paris. Is anyone familiar with the Judgment of Paris?
Teach people at school.
Reminders.
Okay, the Judgment of Paris, right.
Hopefully you realise it's me that you're the weird one.
I used to read these stories when I was a kid. I used to get all of the books out of the library and read them home, but I can't remember.
Okay, well, Judgment of Paris. The gods and goddesses are having a banquet, and everyone's invited except for Eris, the goddess of strife. So she shows up late at the banquet when everyone's there with a golden apple. Okay, and a golden apple is actually very similar to a lot of the things we find in here, the golden peacock and so on. She places the golden apple on the table and says, "It's for the fairest." And then she leaves. Okay? Alright, so Hera gets up, right? Zeus's wife. She says, "Well, here I am, I'm the wife of the greatest of all the gods and so on, and clearly it's for me." And Athena then gets up and says, "Well, I think you're forgetting that, you know, the most profound kind of beauty is inner beauty, and so as the goddess of wisdom, then clearly the apple is for me." And then, of course, not to be outdone, Aphrodite gets up and says, "Lady, but you're forgetting that you're in the presence of beauty herself." Yeah? So it's fairly obvious who the apple should be for. And so then they turn to Zeus. Now, the Judgment of Paris is actually, there's a version of the Judgment of Paris in the Jataka stories. Okay, it's one of those things which is very common. They turn to Zeus and they say, "Well, which one should the apple be awarded to?" Right? Now, Zeus, of course, the most powerful of all the gods, and they said that if you put all of the gods on one side and Zeus on the other, that he would be able to be stronger than all of them. Right? But he wasn't game to answer this question. So he says, "I'm not really able to answer this question." And he sort of thinks for a while and says, "I know who can, and who can answer it is Paris. He's a connoisseur of beauty, and he's the son of Priam, the king of Troy, and he will be able to answer the question for you." So the goddesses all go down, they find Paris, who's living outside Troy somewhere with his missus, who's a nymph, who doesn't fare too well in the story. But anyway, these goddesses come down and they say, "Okay, now we want you to answer this question." And he says, okay, which is the most beautiful? And he says, okay, so he sort of checks them out for a while and then he says, "Well, look, ladies, the bad news is that I can't really make up my mind without being able to fully appreciate your beauty in all respects. So I'll have to arrange a private audience with each one of you where you have to remove your clothes." Of course, normally if a man mortal saw a naked goddess, he'd be killed immediately, but in this case he actually got to have an audience with each of the goddesses. And so when Hera, he was alone with Hera, she kind of takes her clothes off and then whispers to him, if you give me the prize, I'll award you the lordship over all lands." He said, "Oh, okay." So then Athena comes and says, "If you give me the lordship, the prize, I'll award you you'll be the wisest of all men." Okay, and then when he has his audience with Aphrodite, and she says, "If you give me the prize, I'll give you in wife the most beautiful woman in the world." Okay, so then he has to make his decision. So this comes back to that question which I mentioned before, which men have always asked: what does a woman want? Okay, now nobody bothers asking the question: what does a man want? Right? Because the answer to Paris's question is very obvious. Okay, and he gives the prize to Aphrodite and wins the most beautiful woman in all the world. And so that's pretty predictable. And so all of the other two goddesses say in unison, "Bitch!" and disappear. And Aphrodite then takes Paris to meet Helen, who's staying in Troy. And he then abducts Helen. Not quite clear whether Helen actually enjoyed being abducted or not. And took her to Troy, and that was, of course, the start of the whole Trojan War, where Aphrodite was fighting on behalf of the Trojans, and Hera and Athena were fighting on behalf of the Greeks, and the gods tried to stay out of it as much as possible, but got kind of dragged in by one side or the other. And so that's underlying that whole mythology, is this idea. But it's also interesting that in that idea that it's that problem which goes right back to the beginning is that wish or that desire that those women had or the goddesses had for the golden apple. So you see, that form is what I would call like a high...
Sorry, it's just the desire that was invented by whoever wrote the myth, or it's in the minds of the men.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah.
Women make golden apples.
So then there's that cause lay behind the whole thing, but they weren't actually involved in the struggle particularly much. They were involved to some degree, but weren't involved in the struggle all that much. Now, the golden apple is a solar symbol. Okay, it's a symbol of the sun, and this occurs repeatedly throughout Greek mythology. So in that type, that's what I would call a high type of the myth, because it involves the goddesses and it involves this very, very symbolic thing where the solar imagery is very obvious.
Does the myth evolve from the Trojan War itself and people's rationalisation of why the war happened, and the war actually occurred? Sure, Paris, you know, went off and took Helen away,
yeah.
But really the heart of it all was the gods. The gods had this disagreement, and it was the gods whose actions participated that caused it. And that Paris would never have taken Helen if Aphrodite had not taken her into her.
I mean, if you want to look at it historically, it wasn't about war about a woman, it was war about trade routes, right? But it doesn't make a very interesting story.
Measure of pity, that was a counting decision.
Yeah.
What is it in the human psyche? And it's also for the Jaffa times also. We need that these stories actually arise anyway. What is the need for it?
Absolutely. Why does the story arise? And in this case, the story arises because the women created that story. So in this case, the reason that the story exists is because of their actions and their desires, which actually caused the story to come into being. If they hadn't done that, the story wouldn't exist. Yeah. But one of the interesting things about that is that, we were all kind of laughing about that and at the personalistic details, right? And so I kind of hammed it up a bit when I was telling it, but it's also hammed up quite a lot in the actual Greek retellings of it as well, right? But what you see, what actually happens in that is that this wish arises, this desire arises. Now, what's the outcome of that? The outcome of that is strife, vengeance, war, murder, violence, destruction of civilization. But in the mythos as a whole, what also arises out of that is the emergence of new forms, new civilizations, new order. So, for example, the Roman civilization, in its mythos, traced its mythology back to the Trojan War. Okay, so the establishment of the Roman Empire is like the greatest achievement in Europe in sort of political and social terms in ancient times. And the origin of that was from this desire. So the fact that the desire happens, the fact that it's irrational, the fact that it results in destruction, doesn't necessarily mean that the ultimate outcome of it is bad. And that this is also something which I've noticed as a theme recurring in these Jatakas, which is something I found to be quite surprising. and something we'll come back to again and again to see how that occurs in the stories itself. So I'm just wondering whether, it's nearly 6 o'clock, so we probably don't have time to actually go into any of the stories now. We'll start to look at the actual stories next week, and I'll just print out, if I can get this table working, or if I can even just print out the actual jatakas that we'll be looking at, and leave the books downstairs, so if you can get a chance to look at a few of these as we go on, I'll put them in the order that we'll be reading them through. We'll probably look at a few each week.
Yeah.
No. Is that right?
Yeah, no, well, yes. In other words, is that, you know, mysticize culture for a reason.
Yeah.
So what is the driving force behind these myths? What are they trying to rationalize? What are they trying to? Well, does the myth, because the myth can't come first. It's a story that's told afterwards, is it not?
Not necessarily, no. No, myth may often be pre-existing. Stories that help you make sense of it. I mean, myth, in terms of the cultural functions and so on, myth, they form countless cultural functions. They form a sense of identity. It's probably one of the main ones, is they give a sense of identity, and say Buddhist myths give a story of Buddhist identity, so what is a Buddhist community? Or national identity, it might be, in the same case of the story of Rome or something like that, gives a national identity. There's all kinds of things. But what I meant when I said that the myth is often or may be pre-existing, because myths also act as an example for behaviour and influence behaviour. So it's a reinforcing cycle. Yeah. So I mean, just to take this one example, if you've heard that story of this woman and her irrational desires, well, that's sort of giving kind of cues on how women should behave or do behave or something like that. So if and for men as well. So it's not just a pre-existing story. It's also conditioning, but conditioned by, but also conditioning behaviour. So the myth can often lie early.
Is the myth also something like a vehicle to explain the mystical in normal terms? But because this seems to be other than illusion, there's no other vehicle to explain the mystical. How do you talk about gods, or how do you talk?
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. And that's, I mean, in a sense, that's what, you know, that's one of the defining features of myth, is that it addresses spiritual issues that are on a more profound level. Yeah? But, I mean, I might just as a closing comment for today, I just say that I think that, yeah, I've studied myth for a long, long time now, and I think that the overall theme of all myths is the theme of the death of God or the death of the divine and the finding of the self. And that theme can be found in countless forms. So maybe this is something that you can have a look at. It'll become clearer as we look at these stories in different details. But just have a look at the stories as we look at it and see what does that mean? The death of God, or perhaps like the recession or the receding of the divine or the magical or the mystical, and the emergence of the personal and the sense of personal identity. And this is something which is found, I think, as a common theme of all mythology.
Personal in terms of the individual.
Also in collective personal, in terms of, yeah.
Could it also not be just a way of transmitting knowledge? Because, I mean, we like to think now as rational scientific people with satellite technology, but back then they didn't have books and scrolls and all these pleasant kinds of things to transmit information. And sometimes an entertaining story is easier to remember than
So it's a way of passing down the wisdom of the tribe and the community?
Yeah.
Absolutely. And that that ensures, that gives us, it comes back, but that also comes back to this, it's not separate from the question of identity, because that provides a sense of cultural continuity, which is, again, it's exactly what we're doing in Buddhism, as we tell these stories of the Buddha or something like that, and that gives us a continuity.
It's a science lesson, a history lesson, a sociology.
Yeah. Okay. So let's finish by paying respects.